Welcome back to the Environmental Law Monitor. I'm your host, Daniel Pope. This podcast is brought to you by Bracewell LLP's Environment, Lands, and Resources Practice Group, and it's a place for thoughtful conversations. We have conversations ranging from the latest developments to perennial topics like litigation, enforcement, and compliance assurance. We're glad you're spending some time with us today.
When President Trump came into office and immediately filled a Supreme Court vacancy with Justice Gorsuch, many of us wondered whether the Supreme Court would take a different posture towards Chevron deference, the deference established by a case from the 1980s called Chevron versus Natural Resources Defense Council. And as President Trump appointed more justices, that conversation only intensified. Now we are waiting for the Supreme Court to hear argument in a case called Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo, which will address the fees that the government is able to charge companies when the government sends observers to their commercial fishing vessels to make sure that they're complying with applicable laws. And the parties have teed up to the Supreme Court whether it should overrule Chevron deference or limit it in some way. So to help break down the issues we're going to be seeing in Loper Bright, I'm excited to let you know that I've been joined by a special guest today. And so I'm excited to extend a warm welcome to Professor Kristen Hickman, who's the McKnight Presidential Professor in Law and the Harlan Albert Rogers Professor in Law at the University of Minnesota Law School. She's an incredible administrative law scholar, having written and contributed to a number of different publications over her academic career, including Chevron's Domain, which the Supreme Court would actually cite in its 2001 decision in U.S. versus Mead Corporation. Personally, I read some of her scholarship in law school, and I thought it was this like perfect combination of really perceptive and advanced legal thought. And at the same time, it was totally accessible to a novice law student like myself. So I really appreciated that, remembered her, and was excited to welcome her to the show. So thank you so much for being with us, Professor.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
So, you know, I know you posted this on Twitter, or I guess we're supposed to call it X now, but you posted this a while back that you were not going to be writing an amicus brief in Loper Bright. But as I've looked at the pleadings and the amicus briefs, they're all citing to you. So it's going to be really fun to sit down and talk with you about, you know, where Chevron is, what the issues are, where the parties are carving out their territory and sticking their claims. And, you know, maybe we'll have an opportunity to think about what might come after Chevron, if anything. So maybe let's start off with a pretty loaded question. But what did Chevron do when the Supreme Court decided Chevron? What was its effect? How has it changed over the past, you know, almost 40 years? How's it changed administrative law?
So it's funny that when Chevron was decided, not much happened. It was decided by a six-justice court back in 1984. Three justices were recused. It was unanimous among the six justices who participated. Justice John Paul Stevens wrote the opinion, and we know from various sources that he did not intend to make any major statements with his opinion in the Chevron case. But I think really we can attribute the rise of Chevron to Justice Scalia, who at the time of the decision itself was a judge on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. Mm-hmm. At the time that he was a judge, the D.C. Circuit, which reviews, as you know, Daniel, lots of administrative law cases, had gone through a period of time in which the judges on that court had discussed at great length what their role ought to be in reviewing, particularly agency regulations that seem to be exercising a lot of policymaking discretion. And then Judge Scalia's view of that role, I think, was a relatively restrained one in the sense of wanting to get judges out of the business of second guessing agency policy choices, even while continuing to review agency interpretations of law. So, you know, given that debate at the D.C. Circuit, then Judge Scalia, as well as some of his colleagues, I think, developed a theory of what the Chevron opinion might provide. in terms of constraining judicial excesses on judicial review of agency interpretations of statutes. And then Justice Scalia brought those views with him to the Supreme Court, whereupon he, over time, convinced many of his colleagues to go along with the idea of deferring to agency interpretations of statutes when those interpretations were reasonable and the statute was ambiguous, thus signaling a delegation of policymaking discretion from Congress to whatever agency was involved in the case. That vision of Chevron, interestingly, Justice Scalia wrote, or there was an article in Duke Law Journal back in
1989,
that was based on a speech he gave, where he made the observation that applying traditional tools of statutory interpretation, he personally would rarely find statutes to be ambiguous, mm-hmm. and thus he would have relatively few instances in which he would be called upon to defer to agency interpretations. Justice Scalia, as some empirical studies have shown, proselytized judicial deference to agency interpretations of law under Chevron, and yet was one of the least deferential justices himself.
Right.
But some of his colleagues and many judges were more ready to find ambiguity in complicated regulatory statutes, and as a consequence, were more prepared to defer to interpretations of those statutes, the interpretations of those ambiguities by agencies that had more expertise in the subject matter, with the result that through the 1990s, we saw a big increase, it seemed anyway, in judicial deference to agency interpretations of statutes under a variety of different circumstances, not limited to notice and comment rulemaking, for example. And then slowly over time, we have argued, you mentioned the Mead case a minute ago. Mm-hmm. There was also the Brand X case. There's been King versus Burwell. There have been lots of cases over the last 25 or so years in which the justices have debated at greater length, not just how Chevron ought to work in terms of its two steps, but also under which circumstances Chevron ought to apply. One last thing let me point out. I think that there was a point in time in which Chevron deference had expanded to such a degree that it took over, to some extent, the conversation about administrative law, such that mm-hmm. there's a generation of administrative law practitioners and even scholars who think of Chevron and administrative law as synonymous with one another, as though the only thing we talk about in administrative law is Chevron. And of course, that's not right. We have lots of other doctrines in administrative law mm-hmm. that we talk about, including other standards of review of agency action. But nevertheless, Chevron really did dominate the conversation for such an extended period of time. So I think that contributes perhaps somewhat to perceptions of Chevron's significance with respect to the administrative state, which is part of what has led us to where we are today.
Well, and that, that's a great point and a helpful observation, because when I was in law school, it very much seemed like I would be encountering Chevron, in my environmental legal practice on a daily or weekly basis. And I thought, okay, so I'm going to work at a law firm and it's just going to be arguing Chevron step one, step two all day long. And I really haven't dealt with it, at least in that degree, in the 5 years that I've been practicing. And so my next question is, where is Chevron today? Because one of the things that I've noticed, and the parties talk about this in their briefing a little bit, is that, again, coming out of law school, I was expecting an agency to basically just press the Chevron button and say, I win, but that's not the case, at least from my anecdotal experience. And I noticed even one of the cases that we followed quite a bit was a case called Sackett versus EPA, which is about what Congress meant when it said waters of the United States, right? In its definition that governs the jurisdiction under the Clean Water Act. And everyone agrees that's a pretty ambiguous phrase. But even when EPA was defending its position in Sackett versus EPA, you know, it mentioned Chevron deference, but it didn't exhaustively rely on Chevron deference. It was making a bunch of arguments in support of its position. And so it wasn't sort of treating Chevron deference as like a I win automatically kind of position. And the petitioners, at least in Loper Bright, see Chevron as basically already unfavored and no longer a really winning argument. Is that right in your scholarship and observation, or is there something else going on?
So it has never been the case throughout Chevron's history that Chevron automatically means the agency wins. Mm-hmm. There have been various empirical studies over time evaluating agency win rates at Chevron step one, at Chevron step two, under Chevron altogether versus other standards of review or de novo review. You know, there's no question that at one point in time, if an agency could get to Chevron step two, Chevron step two was highly deferential. Mm-hmm. And at least for some judges or justices and in some circuits, perhaps the inquiry at Chevron step one was sufficiently truncated that, at least in the court's opinions, it would seem as though Chevron automatically wins it means the agency wins. Mm-hmm. But empirically, that's never been precisely right. Leaving that aside, though, certainly at the Supreme Court, over the last 7 or 8 years, Chevron has declined in its significance. I saw a presentation back in January by Justice Kavanaugh in which he described the Chevron universe as, well, you have footnote nine people and you have non-footnote nine people, referring to footnote nine in the Chevron opinion itself, which counsels reviewing courts to apply traditional tools of statutory interpretation in evaluating whether the meaning of a statute is clear. And just as Justice Scalia back in 1989 suggested that he rarely found a statute ambiguous because he would apply traditional tools to find statutory clarity. That has been a big part of what's been going on at the Supreme Court. They've been applying traditional tools more aggressively to find statutory clarity and avoid Chevron deference as a result. Certainly, even before Justice Gorsuch joined the court, although not too many years before Justice Gorsuch joined the court, some of the justices started talking about whether Chevron was a good idea, whether Chevron might violate separation of powers principles or was consistent with the text of the APA. And I think with Justice Gorsuch joining the court and with the passing of Justice Scalia, among other things, you started to see the Supreme Court, both for reasons of wanting to be more comprehensive in their evaluation at Chevron step one, but also to avoid some of the arguments over Chevron's validity at all, just not addressing Chevron. That said, you know, so you actually haven't had the Supreme Court defer under Chevron since, I'm not sure if it's 2016 or 2017, the Quozo Speed Technologies case. That was the last time they deferred to an agency interpretation under Chevron. They've mentioned Chevron. Chevron's been raised in a few other opinions since then at the Supreme Court, but they've largely avoided the argument for several years now. But in the meantime, at the circuit court level, agencies continue to request Chevron deference, mm-hmm. and courts continue to grant Chevron deference with a fair degree of regularity. So I would suggest that what you're seeing in the briefing before the Supreme Court is the Solicitor General's awareness and the other party's awareness that the Supreme Court is less enamored of Chevron and less likely to apply it. So consequently, let's focus on other arguments that are going to be more appealing to the justices. Whereas in lower court briefing, Chevron plays at least somewhat of a greater role, even though you also have judges at the circuit court level being more assertive at Chevron step one, following the Supreme Court's lead. So maybe circuit court briefing also, you know, isn't quite so reflexively, if we apply Chevron, the government wins, as maybe it once was.
Mm-hmm. Well, you also mentioned the separation of powers argument that we've seen, and you've seen it in your scholarship for sure, but it's now coming to a point in the briefing in Loper Bright. For the petitioners, they present Chevron deference as a unique threat to our constitutional order of government, right? The judiciary, they say, is backing away from its job of interpreting statutes, of saying what the law is, and enabling Congress to sort of pass legislation with the assumption that, you know, instead of spending time drafting legislation that's going to go into the United States Code, they're going to rush it. They're not going to come up with the appropriate compromises over phrases and sections, and they're going to let the agencies sort it all out. And I think, you know, the government, to its credit, engages on this point and argues that, well, no, Chevron is not an abdication of separation of powers principles. Instead, it's deference as a judicial act of respect for separation of powers and the other roles that are the roles that the other branches play. So what are your thoughts on those arguments on the separation of powers issue or threat, I guess, that's supposedly posed by Chevron?
Sure. So first, I think that argument conflates two different things that are going on. Congress doesn't rely on agencies because of Chevron. Congress relies on agencies because the Supreme Court hasn't enforced the non-delegation doctrine for over 100 years.
That's right.
Back in the 1930s, when you had Panama Refining and Schecter Poultry,
right?
With respect to the non-delegation doctrine, I think that there was more of a sense that Congress couldn't delegate as much power to agencies. But the Supreme Court pretty quickly backed away from Panama Refining and Schecter Poultry and endorsed a broad range of delegations of rulemaking power to agencies over the next several decades after that. And it's really that trend that is what has prompted Congress to rely more heavily on agencies to make some of the hard choices rather than Congress making those choices for itself. We may not have had Chevron deference until 1984, but we had judicial deference to agency interpretations of statutes going back a lot further than that. There's case law from the 1930s that talks about judicial deference to agency interpretations of statutes where it's pretty clear that Congress delegated discretion to agencies to resolve particular matters. You know, so I think complaining about Chevron as violating separation of powers in the sense of allowing Congress to delegate to agencies is conflating Chevron with the non-delegation doctrine or the lack thereof.
Mm-hmm.
With respect to Chevron itself as a violation, as an abdication of the judicial role, to some extent that comes down to how you define ambiguity for purposes of Chevron step one. If you take an interpretation of Chevron that contemplates that courts are going to apply traditional tools of statutory interpretation to find statutory clarity as much as possible, but recognizing that doctrine allows Congress to delegate policymaking discretion to agencies, at some point in the interpretive exercise, you often run out of tools to apply, and you really find yourself in the realm of policymaking and policy choice rather than traditional statutory interpretation, at which point the only thing left for a court to do is evaluate the reasonableness of the approach that the agency is taking in exercising that policymaking discretion. If that is your view of Chevron, then so long as you are on board with the demise of the non-delegation doctrine, there is no separation of powers problem. Mm-hmm. Because the court is exercising its role, fulfilling its role, and applying those traditional tools and reaching a conclusion that the statute is ambiguous. And then turning around and saying, okay, deference to the agency exercising its policymaking role under this statute, so long as the agency is reasonable and not arbitrary, then that does seem like a pretty good balance, right? Mm-hmm. If you think of Chevron as automatically, you know, if you think of ambiguity, you know, there's a judge the judge I used to work for liked to say that some judges would find ambiguity in a stop sign. If you think of, you know, the exercise at Chevron step one as simply one of, well, the text on its face doesn't immediately answer the question before me, thus the statute's ambiguous, and I move straight to Chevron step two without a lot of inquiry into traditional tools, well, then, yeah, I can kind of see the point that judges aren't doing their jobs. But I don't think that's most judges. I don't think it's ever been most judges in most cases. I do think that there was an era, particularly in the 1990s, when particularly judges at the circuit courts of appeals, but occasionally justices on the Supreme Court, really were ready to find ambiguity without a lot of effort. So if you think back to those individual cases, then I see the point about judges abdicating their role under the Constitution. But I would suggest that's certainly not most cases today, and I'm not sure it ever was most cases.
That relates a little bit to the role of stare decisis and all of those 1990s Chevron cases and other, you know, in the four decades that Chevron's been around. You know, the petitioners argue in Loper-Bright that as a judge-made deference canon, basically Chevron is owed very little stare decisis effect. We don't need to care about reliance interests. We don't need to care about all these other interpretations because at the end of the day, we're just talking about what courts are supposed to do when they're faced with a statutory interpretation question where there's some ambiguity. But the government argues that, you know, hey, if you knock Chevron out, then a lot of these settled agency interpretations that have been relied upon, not just by the government, but by the public, by parties, by companies that have made a bunch of investment decisions, right? Those will all topple. And then we'll be thrust back into a lot of uncertainty about what statutes mean. Do you have any thoughts on that particular argument that we see in the briefs?
Well, so I think the idea that so many agency interpretations that were upheld under Chevron automatically will topple is a little bit of litigation hyperbole. I don't think there's anything automatic about these interpretations toppling. I do think that if the court overrules Chevron outright, that to the extent that we've had hundreds or even thousands of agency interpretations of statutes upheld under Chevron, legal uncertainty will certainly arise because we will be left to ask how many of these interpretations will survive and how many will not. Uh-huh. So I think that's genuinely a legitimate concern to the extent that legal uncertainty is not good for business, not good for organizing primary behavior, not really good for the perceptions about the rule of law when you have organized your life around or your affairs around a particular interpretation of a statute that the court has upheld, to then call that into question. You know, that's problematic. On the other hand, you know, let's not get carried away. You know, the republic will not fall if we overturn Chevron deference. That said, the idea that stare decisis shouldn't apply because this is just a judge-made deference canon, personally, I don't think is right. Here I'm going to point to an article I published with a former student, David Hahn, back in 2020 called Categorizing Chevron, that observed in the case law and the academic literature, as well as some of the more popular commentary about Chevron, that you have different ways of conceptualizing what Chevron is and what it does, one of which is as a canon of construction. And on the one hand, canons of construction aren't owed stare decisis. On the other hand, we also don't really overrule them. They come and go in terms of favored status or mm-hmm. less favored status over time. You know, they're just canons of construction are just ways of thinking about statutory text or constitutional text that judges employ, and they do carry very little stare decisis effect. But two other ways of thinking about Chevron, depending on where you stand. One is as a standard of review. In fact, one way of thinking about Chevron is as an interpretation of the text of Section 706 of the Administrative Procedure Act, which on the one hand does call upon reviewing courts to decide questions of law, but also calls upon judges to strike down agency actions when they are arbitrary, capricious, an abuse of discretion, or otherwise not in accordance of law. And, you know, that's the standard that we typically apply when we are evaluating agency exercises of policymaking discretion. Mm-hmm. So there's clearly in 706 sort of this anticipation of an area where the court is dominant and an area in which courts ought to be more deferential to agencies. And David Hahn and I in Categorizing Chevron, but also other academics like Cass Sunstein and Ron Levin have examined, you know, the history leading up to the Administrative Procedure Act, have examined the text of the Administrative Procedure Act and reached a conclusion that Chevron is really a standard of review, you know, and an interpretation of the APA as a statute. Well, you know, statutory stare decisis is pretty robust. Courts are typically very reluctant to overturn interpretations of statutes on the theory that when courts, you know, stare decisis has a strong effect and we have reliance interests on interpretations of statutes. And if Congress wants to rewrite a statute, it can. In fact, we've had proposed legislation over the last 10 to 15 years in which Congress at times has thought about overturning Chevron statutorily and hasn't done it. You know, now that's just proposed legislation. There's only so much that you should take that seriously in terms mm-hmm. of how you interpret legislation, right? But, you know, the third way of thinking about, you know, or also to the extent that Chevron's a standard of review, we don't typically overturn standards of review. More typically, we interpret or reinterpret or reshape or further elaborate how a standard of review is supposed to work, whether you're talking about clear and convincing evidence, or you're talking about abuse of discretion, or you're talking about substantial evidence or arbitrary and capricious, right? Mm-hmm. A third way of thinking about Chevron is as a rule of decision. If this is your fact pattern, then this must be your outcome, right? As a matter of law. And there's some, if you think of Chevron as you sort of framed it, at the outset as if it's an agency interpretation of a statute, then the government wins. Mm-hmm. You might think of Chevron as a rule of decision. We overturn rules of decision in law all the time using the factors that, you know, when courts evaluate whether they should overturn precedent, there's that collection of factors they look at, like reliance, like whether the standard that the court has adopted is workable, things like that. Mm-hmm. And that would be the way you would evaluate Chevron as a rule of decision. And then you might, you know, it might have some stare decisis, it would have some stare decisis effect, but not necessarily controlling stare decisis effect, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, there are different ways of thinking about this question. And that's one of the articles that's been cited in the briefing. And I'll be really interested to see if the justices, you know, pick up on, you know, that framing of the issue before them.
Well, thank you so much for helping unpack some of these issues. I think we're out of time, but I'm excited that you're moving to Austin. You're moving to the University of Texas School of Law, my alma mater. And maybe we'll get to follow up and talk about the Supreme Court's decision in Loper Bright and unpack it. Because one of the questions that I have, we haven't had time to get to is, you know, the possibility of something other than Chevron, which I think we've sort of been circling around. As long as you have lots of agencies, with dealing with complex policy issues on a daily basis in hundreds of agencies, thousands of divisions, thousands and thousands of little offices everywhere. It's hard to imagine courts being called in to resolve every potential dispute over authorizing legislation. And so Chevron does fit this section, especially as you were saying earlier, it's really partly a question of the non-delegation doctrine as well. And so there's so much to follow up on, and we could stay here for another 3 hours for sure, just unpacking these things.
That's it for us today at the Environmental Law Monitor. Big thanks to our guests, as well as Dorn, Emily, and the rest of our production team who helped to make this episode possible. And of course, thank you, our listeners, and we'll talk to you soon.